This episode is brought to you by VMGVinyl.com. Professional record cleaning, restoration, rejuvenation, and grading.
Refresh your records with VMGVinyl.com.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to GrooveWasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All right, here I am, ladies and gentlemen. Mostly gentlemen, I know. Record collecting is a bit of a sausage-heavy sport, but we're aware, we're inclusive, we aspire to be as diverse as possible, and everyone is welcome here on the show. And today's interview, I reckon, is one that everyone will enjoy. I spoke with Dennis Tech, who a lot of you know from his time with Australian legends Radio Birdman. But Dennis has had an incredible career featuring many other musical projects as well. We talk about a lot of them today, including New Race, The Visitors, his solo career. We discuss the legendary Epiphone Crestwood guitar that he bought from the MC5's Fred Sonic Smith. And now Dennis has played for over 5 decades. Dennis shares what it's like having the Prime Minister of Australia be a fan of your band. And of course, we discuss the records, the current reissues, lots of material coming out, including reissues of the Radio Birdman catalog. Dennis shares some great news on that front today. Oh, and by the way, this is the second time we've had Dennis on the show. First time was episode 138, where we discussed some of the rarities of the Radio Birdman catalog. So if you want to hear all about the Burn My Eye EP or the Trafalgar and Sire versions of Radio's Appear, I suggest you check out that episode number 138 of the Vinyl Guide. Today, we touch a little bit on some of those areas, but we also dive deep into some other bits of the career and celebrate 50 years of Radio Birdman with what is likely to be their final shows scheduled for Australia later this year. And they've got some special guests on the tour, including other Aussie legends, Hard-Ons, opening up the Sydney shows. Google up Radio Birdman 5-0 and grab tickets quick. They are selling out fast. And, by the way, there's an extended version of this interview at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head over there now, help support our show, and get all the Patreon extras. I'm not going to belabor the point here. You guys have heard the spiel before. But look, we have plenty of extras up at patreon.com/vinylguide, and we could certainly use your support. So please join us there today, patreon.com/vinylguide. And before we start the interview, I just want to quickly call out a few other Vinyl Guide episodes you may enjoy. I mentioned episode 138 when Dennis first came on the show. That's a great one. We also just reshared our Wayne Kramer interview, and that is one I think everyone will enjoy as well. Vale Wayne Kramer, you legend you. John Densmore of The Doors was just on the Vinyl Guide, episode 433. Rick Beato, that YouTube music juggernaut, he joined us, episode 430. We talked to Eddie Kramer on his Times Engineering, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, Kiss, and more. That's episode 429. We spoke to Ed Cooper of The Saints, episode 396. And we're going to go way back here with the final one I'm going to mention today, episode 127 with James Williamson of Iggy and the Stooges. He's also made music with Dennis Tech, so it's all interconnected here, people. Follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app and enjoy all those episodes and tons more. All right. With that, let's get into our conversation and talk with Dennis Tech on 50 years of Radio Birdman. For some reason, Dennis, you don't seem to be aging nearly as rapidly as I do.
You're not living in this body, so you have no idea.
But, well, I need a different one because I think mine's wearing out.
Well, it's the difference between looking old and feeling old, that's for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, good to see you, man. And I didn't realize we were so close to the cusp of Birdman 5-0. How does it feel now looking back 50 years of Radio Birdman?
I can't believe it's, it seems like I mean, it's so far back that it's like it must have been another lifetime when we started. In one sense, it seems like the time's flown by and where did the time go? But then in another sense, it's like that was so far back that it's in another universe.
So 50 years, there's a handful of shows in Australia. I'm assuming it's this Birdman 5-0 celebration is going to be just Australia. Is that the case?
That's right, yeah. Seven shows. You know, I was thinking about the possibility of doing this for, you know, really for a couple of years, but during the pandemic, we had to stop touring then. You couldn't play anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then late last year, I was in Australia for my daughter's wedding, and I got together with Rob and the rest of the guys, and we talked about it. And so we'll try it. And then our manager started putting dates together. It actually started, the whole idea didn't start until November.
Wow. Okay. Because you knew the 50 years was coming, or maybe it just snuck up on you as well?
Well, yeah. I guess I realized it would be our 50th anniversary a couple of years ago. 74 to 24. It, you know, it's just a number.
And there's actually an eighth show that was announced. I believe there's another show in Sydney now.
You're right. There is now because the first two sold out already.
Are these the last Radio Birdman shows?
One never knows. You know, we're getting pretty old, and I don't know how much longer our bodies will hold up. We're certainly not planning anything beyond this at this point in time, although, you know, when we announced this tour, offers started coming in from other parts of the world. So I guess we just have to consider those and see if it's going to be practical to do it.
Okay. Well, whatever you end up doing, hopefully you'll do another victory lap to where Sydney is the final stop.
It just seems appropriate to play in Sydney last since we started there. And you know, that's really our home.
Who's the band lineup for these shows?
It's the same lineup we've had for 10 years since 2014, several tours. Myself, Rob, and Pip, the keyboard player, that we're all founding members, the three of us. And then we have Jim Dixon on bass, who's been in the band for 25 years now. Mm-hmm. And the two new guys that have been in the band for 10 years are Dave Ketley on guitar and Nick Reith on drums.
Now, with 50 years of Radio Birdman, there's been so many changes, just culturally. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is a huge Radio Birdman fan, and he's quite vocal about his love for the band. So when I think of the progress that the band has made from getting booted out of, you know, just about every Sydney pub to having the Prime Minister wear one of your band's T-shirts, I mean, that must be quite satisfying or mind-spinning, yeah?
It's hard to get my head around that, really. I mean, I like Anthony. He's a really good guy, and he's sort of, he's a little bit younger than us, but he was old enough to be around, you know, when the band started and to know about it. And I don't know if he went to any of those really early shows or not, but yeah, he's a big music fan, and especially Australian rock and roll. So from going from where we couldn't even get our photo in, you know, where reviews in the Daily Mirror were getting spiked because Rupert Murdoch didn't like the look of the photos and said, we're not having this obscenity in our newspaper. And this is the Daily Mirror. There's not a worse rag out there. And to go from that and being banned from not being allowed to play anywhere, and having to start to put on our own shows in garages and things like that, up to now where Albo wants to come to the show and have a beer with us backstage, that is a long distance to go. And, you know, in a way, we in the early days, we got to the point where we kind of reveled in the outlaw stance that was sort of placed upon us, but then we sort of adopted it and said, okay, you know, we'll go with that. We can't do that anymore.
You're now part of the establishment. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Mainstream.
Yeah, for some reason, Albo, he won't wear a hard-on shirt. I'm not sure why, but he seems to always gravitate towards Radio Birdman. So
I haven't seen them with their new lineup with Tim Rogers singing, so that'll be interesting.
Oh, they're fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I moved to Australia, I didn't know a whole lot about a lot of the music scene that happened here that preceded me. I moved here in 2001, so I had a lot of catching up to do, and part of that journey was getting to know the music of like the Visitors and Radio Birdman, the Scientists. Getting to know Radio Birdman was absolutely a highlight. There's a few areas of the history of the band. For example, the Paddo Town Hall show with Radio Birdman, the Saints, and the Hotspurs. That gig seems to be one of legend. Can you share some memories of that particular show?
Well, yeah, there was three Paddington Town Hall shows that year in 77. And the one with the Saints was the first one. I think it was in April. That was the first time that the band rented a venue that large that could accommodate that many people. And the Saints had recently moved from Brisbane to Sydney, and we were helping them get gigs. We were running our own venue by then in Darlinghurst, and we had them play there. And then we put this show on and at the Paddington Town Hall. Yeah, I just remember it was, well, I have some good and not so good memories of that show, actually. Mm-hmm. Chris Bailey took some cheap shots at us that night. He got up, when they got up on stage to play, after they finished, he said, "Now you're going to get to see Hitler Youth." That was his comment about introducing us. And I've never really gotten over that. That was totally uncalled for. But both bands played great, and the audience had a fantastic time and went crazy. And that set the stage for two more concerts at that same venue later that year, one in November and one in December. And the December one was the last show we played in Australia before we left to go to the UK, you know, for Sire Records and go on tour with the Flaming Groovies over there. And that last show at Paddington Town Hall was the one that was really over the top, packed to the gills, and the place was destroyed. It was, I wouldn't exactly call it a riot, but it seemed more like just enthusiastic, you know, crazed party atmosphere more than anything else. But all the windows were smashed, and cars up and down the street, Oxford Street, were smashed, you know, were trashed. And of course, those are the days before you got insurance. I mean, we didn't even think about that.
Oh, were you held liable for it? Was it something that you guys had to pony up for afterward?
Yeah, yeah, that's why I never saw a cent of publishing for that first album. It all went to pay that off. But that gig was recorded on 16-track mobile, and very good recording. And that album is going to be reissued. I'm waiting for the test pressings now. They're supposed to be en route to me, and hopefully we'll be able to get that out with very high quality in time for the tour.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Cause that was going to be one of my questions. Paddo Town Hall, 12th of December, 77 is a great live show. I only have it on CD. The record is very collectible, a little bit out of the price range. So that is being repressed.
Yeah, it's being repressed. The mastering is top notch. Mm-hmm. The files were, or the tape was mastered by William Bowden in Tasmania, and then the lacquer is cut by Levi Seitz in Seattle, and the plates are made at RTI in LA. and shipped to the plant. And that's where we are now with that. We're re-releasing everything in sequence. And it just happens that that's the next one in the sequence, the third album out of seven. And it coincides with this tour. So that's fortuitous.
So every one of the Radio Birdman albums, well, it has, or it will be re-released. You have the tapes, you have everything you need to do that.
Yeah, yeah, we have everything. There's a couple of them that have never been out on vinyl before. The remix of Living Eyes is one of them that's mm-hmm. never been on vinyl. And there's a live album called Ritualism that we did in 96 or 97, and that's never been on vinyl.
There was a release of that, I think, on Crying Sun on vinyl, Ritualism. But that, again, same as a lot of the others, it's highly collectible.
Yeah, CD only, officially. It may well have been bootlegged, but everything's been bootlegged on vinyl. But as far as a, you know, quality release that you want to listen to.
Yeah. So even there was the recent reissue of the international version of Radios Appear, the one that was recorded when you went to Sire. So yeah. I think I was familiar with that you had the tapes from Trafalgar, and you found the ones for Living Eyes, or they somehow came back to you. We'll talk about that in a bit. But the Sire tapes, you had the masters for those as well.
Yeah.
Anything different between those releases and the ones from the late 70s?
Well, these days it's very difficult to make high quality vinyl records because the art of doing it has mostly been lost. Most of the ones that are made today are done by machines. You know, they have a computer program that does the mastering, and it keeps everything well within the safe zone. They don't get anywhere near distortion, and they don't push anything. So records these days tend to sound pretty flat, and there's only a few guys out there that really know how to do it from the old days. Mm-hmm. One of them was George Horn that worked at Fantasy, and he used to do the Creedence records and things like that. We had him before, but he died a couple of years ago, and they're all sort of falling by the wayside. But there's this guy up in Seattle, Levi Seitz, has the equipment. He's got the lathe and he knows how to do it. So what we're trying to do is match the quality of the 70s and 80s releases, which isn't easy to do in this day and age. So if we get it to sound like that, we'll be happy.
Do you have the multi-tracks for some of the legacy albums?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a funny, kind of an odd story. This happened about 10 or 12 years ago. I was living in Sydney, and our manager John called me, and he said that he had heard from the guys at Albert Studios up in Neutral Bay. Albert's, that's mm-hmm. where AC/DC recorded.
Yep.
AC/DC started that studio, Albert's. And we never recorded there, never even set foot in the place. And Albert's called John and said, we found 20 boxes of multi-track tape, 2-inch, 24-track tape. And it looks like it might belong to you. You want to come and pick it up? So John and I went over there, and sure enough, they just had these big stacks of boxes of tape, and all of our old sessions from Trafalgar were in there. And how it got there, we have no idea. Huh. How it ended up in our tape archive room, we have no idea. But we said, yeah, we'll take those back. Thank you. And then we restored them, baked them, and did high quality transfers before the tape fell apart.
Right.
And that was done successfully. As far as Living Eyes goes, that one was recorded in Wales at Rockfield in 1978. And that recording session occurred right in the middle of the breakup between us and Sire. Sire dumped a whole bunch of bands from the label at that point in time. They kept a few, but they dumped almost everybody else. And I don't think that session probably ever got paid for. We were at Rockfield for 3 weeks, and it's first class recording. I mean, you show up there, they give you a cabin to live in, like a farmhouse, and cook all your meals. And there's the studio and the engineer are on call 24/7. You can work anytime you want. So we had 3 weeks there. And so when we left, we didn't get the tape. You know, we didn't have the masters. And I never thought we'd get them, that we'd ever see them again, because it belonged to the studio until they get paid for. Mm-hmm. The original Living Eyes release was cut from a safety copy of the mixes that was at 7.5 IPS. So half the resolution of the actual master.
And not the final mix. It was probably just a rough mix. Would that be fair?
They were the final mixes.
Okay.
That were done, but in retrospect, there were some things about the mixes that we would have done differently. Mm. So fast forward to 96, 95, 96, I was working with Red Eye Records for my solo stuff. And John Foy, the boss of Red Eye, had the idea of trying to find the original masters, multi-track masters for Living Eyes. And it was a long shot, but he actually managed to talk to Kingsley Ward, who runs Rockfield, who was kind enough to go into their archives and see if he could find them, and found them. And John had them couriered back to Sydney, and we remixed them from the original masters. And that is one of the albums that's going to come out in this sequence of reissues, because that's never been out on vinyl, that remix.
Right. It was part of the CD box set, if I recall. Is that the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. It was released on CD on Red Eye. Mm-hmm. And then later appeared in the box set, but it's never been out on vinyl.
So with all these recordings, and you know, you have the masters, you have the control of them, you're doing these shows. They may be the final ones, they may not be, we'll see. When you look back on the legacy of Radio Birdman, are you quite satisfied? Is there anything you'd wish to change, or any regrets regarding the releases or the legacy of the band?
I don't think there's any regrets regarding the releases. You know, we did the best we could in the studio with the resources that we had. And I don't, in my opinion, the recordings are good, but they never really reached the level that the band could reach live. Mm-hmm. And that just may be the fact that there's no audience there, you know, giving you energy back while you play, or mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. But they're good. Recordings are great. I think the songs have stood the test of time. You know, they don't sound dated to me. And I still enjoy playing them. But yeah, if we could have found a way to get more energy on those recordings in the studio, I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the band's legacy, no, it's you know, a lot of bands have told me that they, or have even said in interviews and things like that, that they're motivated by us or inspired, or that, you know, had an impact on their career. And so when you do that, you know, we took from our heroes and we added something to it, and then we passed it along, and I think that's all anybody can ever hope to do. It's perfect.
Mm. So nothing left undone. All tapes are accounted for. Nothing lost, nothing missing, nothing that is left in a condition where you wish it was different.
No, No, not at all. I mean, every time you make an album, and you listen to it later after thousands of hours of working on it and mixing it and doing all that stuff, you always go, "Oh God, there's a missed opportunity there, and there's a missed opportunity there, and we could have done this better." That's inevitable, and there's absolutely no point in dwelling on that.
So once the band split up, there were a few projects, one in particular, which I've really come to, it never is very far from my record player, New Race. And in particular, the first and the last. Tell me the story of the New Race project. It's kind of a Detroit supergroup that played throughout Australia, yeah?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional play-tested third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic, you have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over there now and see what VMGVinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's VMGVinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's VMGVinyl.com. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Once the band split up, there were a few projects, one in particular, which it never is very far from my record player, New Race, in particular, the first and the last. Tell me the story of the New Race project. It's kind of a Detroit supergroup played throughout Australia, yeah?
Yeah, when we released the first Living Eyes release in Australia and New Zealand, we only released it in Australia and New Zealand because we were worried about Sire. They actually had the rights to it, but not in those territories. We retained the rights in Australia. So when we were releasing it in 1981, remember from that safety copy of the mixes, we wanted to have a tour to go with the release. And that is what became the New Race tour. The band was still too uncomfortable with each other, let's say, to get Radio Birdman back together, which would have been ideal, to tour Radio Birdman. It's a Radio Birdman album. Couldn't do that. So it was Angie. It was my first wife, Angie, that had the idea of calling Ron and seeing if he would bring himself and his brother over, Ronnie and Scotty Ashton, and put a band together around that and tour. And that was the original plan. And then Scott dropped out. He, not sure why, but he couldn't go. And so Ron said, "Well, I'll call Thompson and see if he can go."
Oh, so Scott was on board originally.
Originally, he was going to be the drummer.
Wow.
Yeah. So Ron said, yeah, you'll like playing with Dennis Thompson. He's, I said, yeah, I'm sure I will. And so the two of them came out and we got together with Rob and Warwick rejoined for bass. We rehearsed for a week, played around Australia. Yeah. New Race. And then that album was recorded again and using high quality recording gear and that album, the first and the last, was the result of that.
That is such a phenomenal album. Is that also going to get the reissue treatment at some point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in the queue for that as well.
As I understand, there's a couple different versions of the first and the last. One of them a bootleg. Obviously, there's the official one. But the difference being Rob's vocals were re-recorded. Can you clarify kind of what happened there?
Yeah, I found out about all of this later. I wasn't involved in the post-production work on that album at all because I was back in America. But we had recorded three entire concerts and took the cream of that, the best performances, best songs from those three to make one album. And Rob wasn't happy with his vocals. And Rob is never happy with his vocals. Okay. It's just, that's just going to be a given. He doesn't like it. And he doesn't like live recordings for that reason of us. He was given the opportunity and he took it to re-record those vocals. So the official New Race album that came out has re-recorded vocals on it. And they sound fine. I mean, it's the original vocals, I didn't think sounded bad at all. I thought he sang great, but he himself didn't like it. So that's the way it went. Now, Ron had tapes of all the three concerts, original rough mixes, just so that we could all listen to them and decide which songs we wanted to be on the album. So Ron's back in Ann Arbor by now. He's got these tapes. And he ended up selling the tapes to a French record company called Revenge Records. And the albums that came from that, they put two albums out from that.
Like The First to Pay and The Second Wave.
First to Pay and The Second Wave, that's right. And they had like John Wayne and Robert Mitchum on the covers. Yeah. So those albums were cut from rough mixes of the original material and had the original vocal on them. So you can hear on that the vocal is quite good, but Rob was pissed when those bootlegs came out. I mean, they really are bootleg. Revenge didn't see them as bootlegs because they had bought the tapes from Ron Ashton.
Right.
So they thought they had permission and it was authorized and everything, but this created bad blood between Rob and Ron, which went on for years.
So when The First and the Last does get reissued, it'll be reissued in its original form with Rob's redone vocals.
Yeah.
Okay. Did he wipe out the other tracks? Do you know the original vocals off the multi-tracks?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know.
I see a box set coming up. One thing that I didn't realize is that your guitar is actually Fred Sonic Smith's guitar.
Well, it was before I bought it.
It was before. Yeah, exactly. Well, there is that lineage. Tell me the story about that. You're actually playing Fred's guitar. That's kind of your signature guitar.
Yeah, I got that guitar in 73. This predates Radio Birdman. I was in a band called TV Jones then. And I was back in Ann Arbor visiting family, and I just saw an advertisement for it. And it turns out that they, you know, the Five had broken up, and Michael Davis and Fred Smith, Michael Davis and Wayne Kramer had gone to prison. And they were just selling off all their stuff. So that guitar was one of the things that was being sold, and I bought it. The case that it came in had the MC5 logo sprayed on it. And it was really cool. And turns out, fantastic guitar. It was cool for me to have an MC5 guitar. But even cooler was the fact that it was the perfect guitar for me to play. It fit my hand perfectly, and it's just an amazing instrument. And so, yeah, that's the story. I bought it and took it back to Australia. And I don't know, must have played it at 1,000 gigs. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's so associated with you. And what I thought was most interesting is when you were playing in the MC5 tour, the 2004, and you played numerous times with Wayne Kramer, you're actually playing those same parts on the same guitar.
Yeah. It's, I mean, nobody can replicate Fred Smith's parts exactly, but I played an approximation of Fred's parts and added some of my own into it on that exact same guitar. Yes.
Yeah.
Fred tried to buy it back. Fred Smith tried to buy the guitar back from me a couple of times. When we were in London in 1978, we ran into those guys over there. Iggy was doing a tour with basically the Sonics Rendezvous Band as his backing band. He had Fred Smith playing guitar and Gary Rasmussen on bass, Scotty Ashton on drums, and Scott Thurston on keyboards. So we went to the show and had dinner with them, and Fred asked me about the guitar. He said he'd really like to buy it back. And by that time, I had owned the guitar and played the guitar for a lot longer than he had owned it. And I said, I really don't want to sell it back to you because this is my guitar now. And he says, okay, fine. And Fred was a super nice guy. He was always very, very quiet guy, kind of shy, but always good to me. He's always good to me. And he had me get up with Sonics Rendezvous Band a couple of times and play City Slang using that guitar, because he wanted to have extra guitars on that song. Apparently on the recorded version, there's 12 guitar tracks on the single. But anyway, and then after Fred died, Patty wanted it. But she wouldn't ask me directly. She asked Scotty to ask me if she could have that guitar back. And again, my answer was no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've created a lot of history on that guitar yourself. What will happen to that guitar once Dennis Tech joins the Wayne Kramer band?
My kids will get it.
Yeah. I think a museum piece. We talked to Fat Mike, the punk rock museum, and he wants to put together an Australian display, Australian music, and he's getting some Saints stuff and the like. But one of the things we talked about is that Radio Bird, Dennis Tech's guitar. How would that look in here, in this museum?
He'll have to talk to Hannah and Max about that and see, you know, when they own it.
Yeah, fair enough. And I'm assuming that guitar is going to be making an appearance at the Birdman 5-0 gigs.
Thinking about it, I haven't played it. The last time I took it out on tour was 10 years ago. So, yeah, maybe. Thinking about that right now.
Mm-hmm. Is it a little bit worse for wear? Will it make the trip? Is that the worry?
Oh no, it's fine. It looks like crap. You know, all the paint's gone and it's you know, it's got rust stains from where the screws have rusted into the pick guard and it looks terrible, but it's actually quite intact and plays well.
Yeah. Well, you've seen what Willie Nelson did to his guitar, and it works fine.
That guitar had the neck broken off 3 times.
Okay.
While I was using it a lot, and it the last time that happened, I took it to Dan Earlywine. You know who Dan Earlywine is?
I do not. I do not.
Whole story there, but he's a highly respected and renowned guitar luthier and guitar repairman from Ann Arbor. Originally, he was the guitar player in the Prime Movers when Iggy was the drummer.
Okay.
And he was my first guitar teacher. But he later found fame as a, he wrote the guitar repair column in Guitar Player magazine and wrote books on guitar repair he was the man to get, you know, to fix your guitar. So I took it to him, and he made that guitar so that neck will never come off again. He put this reinforcement into the neck body joint, which was weak in those guitars to begin with. And he put interlocking splines of wood to lock that neck in there. And then he refinished it so that the part that he worked on looked like it was exactly the same age as the rest of the guitar. You can't even see it. Mm-hmm. Look at the back of that guitar, the neck body joint, and you can't tell that it was ever worked on. It was just incredible. And he made a video, it's like this 16-part video of him, how he did it and everything.
Wow.
For students to watch.
Well, hopefully we'll see if that guitar makes an appearance in Sydney in July. You've been working with the Citadel label for 40 years, maybe longer. I think originally from the 100 Fools single all the way to the current reissues of Radio Birdman. That's an extraordinary relationship to have with a label.
Yeah. My relationship with John Needham, the label manager, goes back further than that. I've been close friends with John since 72. Hmm. We shared a student house together in Sydney, you know, and so we've been together ever since.
And I do want to point people over to Citadel Mail Order for various reissues and a lot of Radio Birdman gear. And if you want a shirt like Anthony Albanese, well, they got those up there too.
That's right.
CitadelMailOrder.com. You also work with the Wild Honey Records in Italy, which is a great label. I get a lot of stuff from them. They got some phenomenal bands, BBC and others. And you've got a pretty strong relationship with them as well for your solo stuff. How did that relationship come together?
It started with before the Wild Honey existed. The label boss Franz Barcella was running tours in Europe, and so he managed a couple of my solo tours way back, and we formed a friendship then. And when Birdman got back together and started going back into Europe, I brought them into his touring agency, which was a great relationship. And then when he started the label, he just said, you know, what can I put out on the label of yours? And I said, well, I've got about 15 or 20 solo albums. Where do you want to start? So he started at the beginning with Take It to the Vertical and the Visitors album. And Outside is going to be the next one. And it's scheduled for a March release coming right up. There's going to be a double 12-inch vinyl of Outside with the original Outside from the CD and lots of additional tracks.
And that's coming out on vinyl?
That's coming out on vinyl. It's
going to
be a double 12-inch.
Okay. I noticed on several of your solo albums, even right up to Long Before Day, there's a U.S. version and, I guess, an international version, you know, with slightly different song sequences and inclusions. Why the difference between the versions?
That would depend on which one you're asking about.
Like Long Before Day. I think Long Before Day, Mean Old Twister, there's slight differences, but Long Before Day, I know, has a different song order.
Well, Long Before Day was only out on CD in America. Mm-hmm. There was no American vinyl of Long Before Day. So the only vinyl of that is European. Obviously, there's, you know, CD and vinyl are going to have different song sequences.
Hang on a sec. Let me confirm. I thought that there was two different versions. Don't mean to be pushy.
Well, that's okay. You probably know more about it than I do.
Maybe I got to eat my words here. Maybe my research failed me, Dennis.
Ann just handed me a note here. The vinyl came out in two different colors.
Okay.
The green one and a white one.
Mm-hmm.
Both are on Wild Honey. But they're the same otherwise. And I think the green one was for Wild Honey's American distribution. And the white marbly one was for their European distribution. But it's the same album and the same song sequence. I left the vinyl to Wild Honey because Franz has one of his hats is that he works at a pressing plant mm-hmm. part-time. And so he has an ability to get ahead in the queue.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get vinyl press these days. You know, if you can find anybody that'll even take your order, a lot of them won't even take your order anymore. Like Third Man, you try to get something pressed there, they won't even answer the phone. Furnace has where I used to get my records pressed, my American pressings.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit and Twister and Lost for Words pressed at Furnace. And they have a 2-year waiting time.
Wow.
Erica, where we pressed the James Williamson album, the 2-to-1, they won't take orders. They're fully booked. So it was just too hard to do vinyl for me to organize vinyl in America at this point in time. So just have Franz do it over there. He's got the pressing plant. Mm-hmm. Their presses sound great. Let him do it.
Fair enough. He also does these really interesting, I call them stunt records, where, you know, it's a crazy packaging or something very ambitious. He's creative. I'm a big fan of Wild Honey Records. One of the really collectible releases of the Radio Birdman catalog, I don't know if it's collectible so much, it's just obtuse, is the Soldiers of Rock and Roll album. There was a version of that album released showing I think it's a German army on the cover. There were only about 30 copies that made it to the stores before it was recalled and reissued with a white cover. I think this was done in the days where you weren't even in Australia. What do you recall about that whole release?
That completely took me by surprise. I had no idea they were even doing that. And it just seemed like a crazy concept anyway, you know, to have interview material on an album. Of course, when we saw the cover, we had to say, stop, you know, what do you guys must have lost your minds. We're having enough trouble already with people, you know. Yes, if there's any one thing I regret or would change, it would be that we are labeled as having some sort of right-wing political affiliation, which nothing could be farther from the truth than that. But once you get something like that, it takes on a life of its own. And, you know, I mentioned to you what Chris Bailey said at that concert.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an article that came out in one of the Melbourne newspapers written by Red Simons. He wrote an editorial complaining about us being Nazis. And this stuff takes on a life of its own. And if you put a cover like that on a record with our name on it, aren't you just throwing petrol onto the fire? It's just insane. It's just insane. By the way, I'll just take this opportunity to say once and for all, Radio Birdman does not have any political affiliation whatsoever or inclination to do any sort of propaganda. And if there was any political system that could be even remotely associated with us, it'd be anarchy. Anything else, forget it. So yeah, so that album, Soldiers of Rock and Roll, it's just really misguided, dumb idea, which if I had been around and they would have asked me, I would have never approved.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they did it because the band the band had stopped existing and they wanted to put something out. That's all I can think of.
But something that provocative. Do you know who approved that or who designed that?
Well, it had to come through Trafalgar, didn't it?
It was WEA, I think.
Yeah, WEA, but Trafalgar was who we were signed to.
Right.
And they were going through WEA. You know, the first album was on Trafalgar's own label, and then Trafalgar had a deal with WEA for reissues after that.
Yeah, it just shows the label WEA. Yeah, I'm sure there's probably some sort of agreement in the back about usage of the music and everything, but
yeah, well, Trafalgar is the middle entity that stands between us and WEA in those 80s reissues.
So suffice to say, Soldiers of Rock and Roll, old cover, new cover even, won't be part of that re-release schedule.
No.
Okay. Fair enough. The Visitors. How quickly after Birdmen disbanded were the Visitors formed?
About a year later.
And as I understand, there was about a dozen shows within Sydney. How many recordings? There seemed to be a lot of sessions, a lot of music that was generated by that band in that short period of time.
Well, we only had one proper recording session. Mm-hmm. And it was Charles Fisher organized it. And it was at a little studio in Sydney called Palms, the Palms. The guy just had a Tascam 8-track. Mm. And we set up like live and just played through our set. And then there were a couple of overdubs put on later at Trafalgar of some vocal parts. But there were no guitar overdubs. That was all done live. And keyboards, the guitar, keyboards, bass, and drums, all live. Mm. And we recorded that whole album in one afternoon.
So that's the one and only recording session of the Visitors. Everything we hear of the Visitors came from that day.
Came from that day, or people who recorded us at live concerts.
Okay. There's one of those 12 live concerts.
Yeah, there's a few of those out there.
Wow.
I think Dave Lang has some live recordings of us that aren't too bad. Mm-hmm.
And some of those recordings, they made it to a record on Phantom Records. Phantom Records being associated with the Phantom record store in Sydney. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you recall about that Phantom release and working with the record shop for that?
Well, that was the first, you know, we had recorded these, our set in that session, in that one session. And then Phantom was Jules Normington and Dare Jennings, as I recall, were running Phantom. And they said, can we put a record out, an EP from, they'd heard about the sessions. Maybe I had played some of the songs to them. I don't remember exactly, but they offered to do an EP and a 12-inch EP. And so, yeah, okay, we'll take these back into Trafalgar and, you know, and maybe add a backing vocal or two. And, you know, like we put backing vocals on Journey by Sledge. I can't remember what else we did in there, but nothing to the music. It was just vocal parts that got fixed up. Mm-hmm. And they put it out as that EP, four songs on Phantom. And then it was much later, maybe a year or more, a year or 2 years later, that John Needham decided to do the whole thing as a full-length LP on Citadel. Again, crazy album cover. I mean, I don't know what these people are thinking, really. I kind of like it now, but at the time I'm going, what is this? These South American like totems or statues?
Yeah.
Green, yellow, and silver as a color combination? Who thinks this stuff up? The photo on the back of the album, though, is great.
That cover always struck me as very, I don't know, the 80s were a weird time.
Kind of crazy, but like I say, I like it now.
Well, people want to hear what we're talking about. There's also a, you know, Dennis Tech's website, DennisTech.com. You document a lot of these things very, very well. But the visitor's music is also available. Again, there's a reissue from Wild Honey you can get online. You've got a lot. I mean, the access and the filing and preservation of your music has been phenomenal. We speak to so many artists who have no idea where their tapes are, and you seem to have kept them all together quite well throughout your life.
So lucky that Albert Studios called us. They just had stuff in a dumpster.
Yeah, those Trafalgar masters, you must have found outtakes, different songs on it, and anything unique you found on those recordings?
Hundreds of things that I didn't even remember doing that were on those tapes. And I spent weeks going through everything that was on there. And it was only the very best or most interesting stuff that made it into that box set.
So you've got the Birdman shows coming up. You've got a whole slate of reissues coming up. How about new music? What else do you have on the in the hopper?
Right. I have the great good fortune of having recorded many tracks with Rick Parnell that have never been finished. These recorded about 7 or 8 years ago. On some of them, it's all just me playing rhythm guitar and some soloing and him playing drums, just the two of us on these tapes. And on some of them, the guitar is quite good and usable. On others, the guitar needs to be replaced, but the drumming tracks are perfect and they sound great. And they were mic'd properly and recorded properly, and his performances are stellar. So I'm building on that for a new album.
Okay. Is that something you think we'll see in 2024? You got a pretty packed year, so is that something we'll see sooner than later?
I'm going to try to have it the recording of it finished before the Birdman tour, and then it'll be in the pipeline. So we'll see if Wild Honey wants it, or who, Cleopatra, or whoever wants it. Maybe by the end of the year, or maybe early next year, see the light of day. But I'm really excited about it because the drumming is so fantastic, and it's going to be really featured. And these songs are being built around those drum tracks. And I've never really recorded or written that way before. I've never written a song to a specific drum part before, but I'm doing that now, and it's really interesting, and it's coming out quite differently than I expected, but very cool.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that. It's always great when we get a new Dennis Tech release out, and we've been fortunate enough to have a pretty steady stream of them in the last several years, so look forward to that continued streak. One last thing before we wrap up, and this isn't so musical, but I just want to get your story, your angle on this. The Top Gun call sign, as we understand, the Val Kilmer's character in there was known as the Iceman, which I believe was your call sign. There may have been a little bit of lifting of that name. How do you remember the story, or what's your angle on that story?
Well, yeah, I'm the original Iceman, okay? Right. So it was my call sign before the movie. The movie people came out, you know, when they were making that movie, they were doing research by sending people out to see how a fighter squadron actually operated. And so the team came to our squadron and kind of lived with us for 2 weeks. They hung around, you know, when we'd walk out to the airplanes, with us. They never got any rides, but they really looked at every aspect of it and they made notes. And of course, everybody has their call sign on their name tag, on their flight suit, and on their helmet. And so they would have seen it. They would have seen that there was an Iceman in that squadron. And then they go away. And then a year and a half or 2 years later, the movie comes out. And it has an Iceman. Was that just a coincidence? Yeah, maybe. maybe that was already written into the script before they ever, you know, ran into me. I don't know. But the legend that grew around that is that they got the call sign from me. I don't know if that's true. Maybe it's not. I really don't know.
Good. Which came first?
Movie people deny it. They when asked, they say, well, no, any resemblance to people living or dead in this movie is purely coincidental. They have to say that, but who knows?
Were you still using the Iceman call name when the movie came out?
Yeah, but it ruined it.
Okay. How did it ruin it?
Well, there's this silly movie, right, which really wasn't very realistic at all about naval aviation, and had a lot of Hollywood slapped on it that real pilots would look at and go, oh God, yeah, that would never happen. But and then the character was not the most savory person either. The Val Kilmer character, he was kind of an asshole. And then, of course, after the movie comes out, that's where you got your call sign from. You know, I didn't totally ruin it, but, you know, my friends that I get together with from the squadron still call me Iceman, and they don't think twice about it.
So you didn't change your name to something else just to avoid the hassle?
One of the things about the Navy, and this doesn't apply to the Air Force, they're different, but in the Navy and in the Marine Corps, once you get your call sign, it can never be changed. Almost never. It takes an extraordinary event to change a person's call sign. You have it for your whole life from then on. So you want to get a good one. I mean, because if you don't get a good call, that's too bad. You're stuck with it. I mean, we had some pretty funny ones, but anyway.
So you're still the Iceman.
I'm still the Iceman.
Okay. All right.
Especially when I go to those Phantom pilot reunions, which I went to one last year. And God, that was fun seeing those old guys.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. You got to write a book. Hopefully, is there a book in progress?
There is. There is a book in progress.
Good.
It's not focusing too much on the music, because that part's being covered by Murray Englehart. Did you know that Murray's got a book coming out this year?
I do not. I did not know that.
It's okay for me to talk about it. It's he's written the definitive book about Radio Birdman, and its release date is scheduled for June. The publisher, it's all approved. It's in the final editing stages now. The manuscripts went in last September, but he worked on this book for several years. Mm-hmm. And he went into great depth about everything. Because he was doing that, I don't want to cut across that. You know, it's like he's really got the definitive saga coming out. And yeah, there will be some music stories that he doesn't know about that I'll put in, but mostly it'll be other stuff.
Right. Well, you've lived a big life, so there's plenty to cover.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there'll even be one at the those books available at the merch table at the 5-0 shows. We'll see what happens. But again, Dennis, thank you so much for coming on the show. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Again, folks, go to citadelmailorder.com, especially if you're in Australia. You could also check Dennis's Bandcamp, DennisTech.bandcamp.com, or WildHoneyRecords.bandcamp.com. You could also go to DennisTech.com. There's a lot of coverage and a lot of information on the various releases and stories behind those records that we collect. Dennis, again, congrats on 50 years of Radio Birdman. Long may you fly, and we'll see you in Australia in June and July.
Sounds great, Nate. Thanks. We'll see you then.
What an absolutely lovely dude. Thank you, Dennis, for coming on the show. And I got to, if you're listening to this and you're in Australia, you need to get your Radio Birdman 5-0 tickets quick. Sydney has had three shows. They have three shows. Two of them have already sold out. So wherever you're at, if tickets are available, snap them up quick because, you know, this is probably, you heard what he said. It's probably going to be the last time you're going to be able to see him live. And man, what a show. I just saw him a few years ago and absolute legend. So catch him while you can. Radio Birdman 5-0. And by the way, we've got an extended version of this interview available only to show patrons, patreon.com/vinylguide. While Dennis and I were talking, he had an earthquake. It's kind of funny. We're talking through it. So, that's only up at the Patreon feed, the extended version. So, join us up there, patreon.com/vinylguide. And thank you in advance for your support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hey, do me a favor. Jump up on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a positive review. All right, say something nice, 5 out of 5 stars. That is always super helpful. Big thanks and big ups to everyone out there who's sharing these episodes on social media and putting them in the Reddit forums and the Facebook groups. That's hugely appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Follow The Vinyl Guide in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use and enjoy the full back catalog of episodes of The Vinyl Guide podcast. Thanks again for listening.